guys, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. As James Froude, the brilliant 19th century British historian, wrote, "History is a voice forever sounding across the centuries, the laws of right and wrong." Today's show previews some of this season's top books, offering up new perspectives on everything from the Civil War's William Tecumseh Sherman to both World Wars, and on to the war many believe is festering between the Clintons and the Obamas. Just last month, we commemorated the 40th anniversary of Richard Nixon's resignation. My guest today, John Dean, is one of Watergate's last surviving figures. We'll discuss his new title, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. We're set to uncover titles sure to spark your interest. So let's turn now to page one of the book report. As you may know, the term of the Supreme Court begins, by statute, on the first Monday in October. As that date is drawing near, I wanted to begin today's book report with a new title from Lawrence Tribe and Joshua Matz, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. From Citizens United to its momentous rulings regarding Obamacare and gay marriage, the Supreme Court under Chief Justice John Roberts has profoundly affected our lives. Yet for most of us, the court remains mysterious, and the motivations of the 9 men and women who serve for life seem obscure. Political gridlock, cultural change, and technological progress mean that the court's decisions on key topics, including free speech, privacy, voting rights, and presidential power, will have lasting impact. Acutely aware of their opportunity, the justices are rewriting critical aspects of constitutional law and redrawing the ground rules of American government. Tribe, one of the country's leading constitutional lawyers, and Matz dig deeply into the court's recent rulings, stepping beyond tired debates over judicial activism to draw out hidden meanings and silent battles. The undercurrents they reveal suggest a strikingly different vision for the future of our country. Holter Graham narrates.
H.L. Mencken reputedly said, "For every complex problem, there is a solution that is simple, neat, and wrong." Understanding the Supreme Court undoubtedly qualifies as a complex problem. The 9 justices currently issue more than 70 opinions every year, some of them thunderbolts that rock American life, and others rightly destined for obscurity. With a hand in nearly every major issue of our time, from privacy and affirmative action to gun rights and health care, the court is inescapable. Yet it is also mysterious and secretive, committed to rituals and reasoning that even experts struggle to understand. Its opinions are poked and prodded, examined under a microscope, and held up to the light. The public hangs onto rumors of backroom drama, while scholars read tea leaves and prophesy the future. Clear trends predominate in certain areas of law, but efforts to develop a unified field theory of the court, to explain its work as the result of a particular clash of politics, personalities, or principles, inevitably fall short. Even in this age of statistical models that seek to wring hidden meaning out of human behavior, the 9 men and women who make up the court intrigue and surprise us. Consider a handful of the court's rulings since 2005, when John G. Roberts, Jr. was appointed Chief Justice of the United States. In 2008, faced with a challenge by detainees held at Guantanamo Bay, the Roberts Court struck down an act of Congress regulating national security in wartime. That same year, a narrow majority invoked the Constitution's original meaning to hold that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to keep and bear arms. In 2010, the court issued Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission, triggering heated debate over corporate money in American politics. Then, in 2012, the court upheld Barack Obama's signature achievement, the Affordable Care Act. Since 2012, this court has also blocked state efforts to regulate immigration, limited warrantless GPS surveillance, invalidated part of the Voting Rights Act, and held that part of the Defense of Marriage Act violates the rights of same-sex couples. Trying to comprehend the legal precedents, constitutional philosophies, and judicial personalities that shape these wildly divergent decisions can seem overwhelming. Of course, an effort to understand the Roberts Court, much like an effort to understand the court at any point in history, must reckon with more than just its results. The court issues opinions in which the justices grapple with fundamental principles, argue over what the Constitution means, and what role they should play in giving it life, and offer signals of where they are heading. These opinions open a window into the justices' hearts and minds, giving us a glimpse of how they view the world. In many cases, the justices' decisions, as well as their concurrences and dissents, also exert a magnetic pull on American life, both in their practical effects and through their bold interventions in our discourse. When Justice Sandra Day O'Connor warned that a state of war is not a blank check for the president, and when Roberts condemned the sordid business of divvying us up by race, they spoke to the public about constitutional values in ways that can't simply be reduced to how they voted in those cases. Judicial opinions, though, can defy easy comprehension. Far too often, their meaning is misunderstood. It doesn't help that in controversial cases, the court frequently erupts in a confusing cacophony of competing writings. Nor do its opinions always offer a comprehensive and transparent view of the court. Sometimes they are downright misleading. The complex problem, then, is that the Supreme Court presents many kinds of uncertainty. What is really going on within the court? What moves the justices to take the actions they do? How will they resolve the issues that reach them in the future? What roles do they see for themselves? Are they achieving what the Constitution requires or justice demands?
We've just heard Uncertain Justice by Lawrence Tribe and Joshua Matz. As you might expect, there's been a great deal of coverage commemorating the 40th anniversary of Richard Nixon's resignation. There have been panel discussions, newspaper stories, TV interviews, and much more. Today, the Book Report speaks with John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the scandal, and whose Senate testimony led to Nixon's resignation. In his new book, The Nixon Defense, Dean draws on his own transcripts of nearly 1,000 conversations, a wealth of Nixon's secretly recorded information, plus more than 150,000 pages of documents in the National Archives and the Nixon Library to provide the definitive answer to the question, what did President Nixon know and when did he know it? Dean connects dots that have never been connected, including revealing how and why the Watergate break-in occurred, what was on the mysterious 18-and-a-half-minute gap in Nixon's recorded conversations, and more. In what is being hailed as an authoritative account of one of America's worst political scandals, the Nixon defense shows how the disastrous mistakes of Watergate could have been avoided, and offers a cautionary tale for our own time. John, welcome to the Book Report.
Thank you.
Will you describe the research process you used for the book? How long did it actually take?
What happened is, when I decided to do this book, I assumed many of the recordings that I thought I needed to do the book had already been transcribed or would be easy and not many. To make a long story short, I first had to catalog, because nobody had done so, all of the Watergate conversations. The National Archives has done a wonderful job, and in fact, I dedicate the book to them because it's kind of thankless work they've been doing for four decades. They've gone through all the conversations, extracted anything that's personal, like Nixon talking to his doctor or his wife or his kids or what have you, and anything that's of national security nature. So in that process, they list everybody who's on the given conversation, and then they don't have transcripts, but the gist of the conversation. Like if Kissinger comes up, it might be Vietnam or diplomacy or peace talks or whatever, which is, excuse me, a guide of sorts. So I went through all of these subject logs and was able to extract all the Watergate conversations, and I found roughly 1,000 conversations. I then looked to see if any had been which had been recorded. I knew some of them had. About 80 of them were recorded, transcribed by the Watergate prosecutor. About 12 of those conversations are excellent transcripts because the Watergate defendants had obviously paid attention to them and corrected them and what have you. The rest of them are just first drafts by FBI secretaries and not terribly good. They sometimes don't even have the right person speaking. So I knew I had to do those over. Then Stanley Cutler, the historian, had selected conversations, about 320. He just thought, his criteria was, does this look like an interesting conversation? I looked at his, I played his conversations. I listened to the tape and went through them and realized his transcripts often have huge gaps in them. An ellipses could be 30 or 40 minutes of material I found important to try to put the pieces together to understand what was going on. So I found I had to do all of the conversations, about 1,000 of them, about 600 that nobody probably outside the archives had ever listened to or certainly had not tried to transcribe, and I had to redo most of those that had already been transcribed. So that's what made it a mammoth project.
Well, after all the research and the thousands of hours you spent listening to the tapes, were there new things that came to light that truly surprised you?
Oh, boy. Every page of the book has something that is new to me. Even my own conversations. I had the transcripts before. I didn't have the audio. And audio can tell you an awful lot about mood, and particularly when it's you talking and you know you can relive that conversation. So there's much that's new. There's new activities we didn't know about. We're literally looking at it day by day. The story has much more drama than I had suspected it have. It is much more telling of human nature and the way he made his decisions. And I think my overriding question in taking on the project was, how could somebody as savvy as Nixon get himself in the mess he got himself into? How could he let this bungled burglary destroy his presidency? Well, I understand that today. Bob Woodward, who there's little he doesn't know about Watergate, said to me, and did a wonderful review, said, you just have put a microscope on this and just answered all the questions.
Right. Well, I think it's safe to say the majority of Americans believe Nixon absolutely authorized the Watergate break-in. But you believe otherwise, correct?
There is just not a scintilla of evidence that he ordered the break-in. Now, did he create an atmosphere where they would do this? Absolutely. Absolutely. But what's ironic is, He did ask, he instructed his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, to have a plant, which could be anything from an electronic device to a secretary to a chauffeur to an intern, put in his opponent McGovern's office. And that was the mission that Liddy and his crew that got arrested at the Watergate were on. When they merely stopped by the Watergate to fix a defective bug, and they'd never been able to find Larry O'Brien's office when they went in there the first time. And had they been arrested at McGovern's office, it's traceable right back to Richard Nixon.
I have to wonder why the break-in in the first place. Did Nixon ever think he would actually lose the election to McGovern?
Well, I think he wanted the material on McGovern. He wanted to know everything he could. There was probably some confusion in communications, too, because Haldeman is putting a lot of pressure on the re-election committee to make sure they have copies of all of McGovern's speeches. And what he had in mind, what he later said on the tapes, is I just thought they could go to a rally where McGovern was speaking and just record it with an open recorder. But he said that he could see later how they could confuse that, too. Not that he was above bugging by any stretch of the imagination.
You know, there's so much speculation about what happened to Martha Mitchell, some dire conspiracy to lock her up and silence her. Will you talk about the Mitchells for a bit?
Well, there was surprising detail because the Mitchells were deceased at the time I got to those tapes. And all that material and all that background on Martha Mitchell and what her role was and what her problems were was discussed rather openly with the president. And he felt it was Martha who caused John Mitchell to keep his eye off the store, if you will, and let these things happen. I'll let the reader go through all that material because it's interesting, but it's sad also. I mean, she's a tragic character.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about Deep Throat. Did you know his identity while the Watergate scandal was going on?
We didn't even know there was a character called Deep Throat. Until Woodward and Bernstein published their book in, I guess it's 74 is when All the President's Men come out. And I'm out of there by then. But we did know who he was, and we didn't know we knew who it was, because we knew that Mark Felt was a serious leaking problem. And there are tapes where that is being discussed, because I have been tipped off by the head of the criminal division that an attorney for one of the publications to whom Felt was leaking came to the head of the criminal division because he was worried they were getting what might be grand jury information or some other proprietary type of information that could put them in an obstruction of justice situation. So Henry Peterson, the head of the criminal division, when he told me this, he said, I haven't told the attorney general yet, who was Dick Kleindienst. I haven't told the acting director of the FBI for fear of their reaction. But I think the White House should know that Mark Felt is a serious leak problem. He said, I was in the FBI when he first went there, and I watched his career, and he said, John, they know him as the White Rat. I said, why do they call him the White Rat? Well, I knew he had premature white hair, but they said that it's because he talks to the press so much. So his colleagues knew he was a leaker as well. He's clearly trying to get the job of director of the FBI. He's the number two man. And Nixon has some interesting comments on him. It's a hell of a way to do it, he says, because Felt obviously was not as slick as he thought he was. He was a very Machiavellian type fellow, but was not pulling the wool over anybody's eyes with his leaking.
Let's talk about the infamous 18 and a half minute gap. You believe the gap is still a mystery, but you must have your own thoughts as to what the content was.
Well, I do. I can narrow down to the five people. I put that in an end note who could have done the erasure, and I have no reason to doubt the report that was given, excuse me, to the court saying it was intentionally erased. And it's also to me, when you listen to all these tapes, quite evident what was erased. It was simply the fact that he knew of the cover up. On June 20th, which was the first day he's back, and he's talking about it long before he set up his defense, that he had no knowledge of the cover-up. So this, when they subpoenaed this tape after it was surfaced that they existed, it destroyed his defense right off. If you look at the history and follow the conversations in the book, you see he talks about it on the 20th, he talks about it on the 21, 22. Later, they do subpoena the 23rd, which are become known as the smoking gun tapes because they destroy his defense. So that's clearly what it was. It was just a conversation about covering up, and he got caught.
Watergate was one of our country's worst political scandals, yet it seems very removed from public consciousness just now. What would you like the book's legacy to be? What will the next generation learn from your research?
Well, I think the generation that lived through Watergate needed to have the answers to the questions, and I think the next generation needs to know what happened. I tried to tell a story and use narrative and dialogue. These tapes lend themselves very nicely to just telling the narrative and drawing it from this remarkable primary source, the likes of which we'll never have again. And fortunately, I'm being told by people. I had somebody sent me an email last night who is about halfway through, and she's a former English teacher. And she said, John, this reads like a novel. And that's exactly the sort of thing an author, of course, likes to hear.
John, any final thoughts?
I hope particularly young people read this book, because we have a tendency to repeat our history. I think that it you don't need to be a presidential historian or a presidency buff or even a history buff. There's just so much in here that affects how people live their daily life. And the drama is pretty good.
I'll say. Thank you so much for joining us today, John.
Thank you.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of the Nixon defense, what he knew and when he knew it, narrated by Joe Barrett.
Before now, no one has attempted to catalog and transcribe all of Nixon's Watergate conversations and to examine and reconstruct this history based on this primary source material, the likes of which has never before existed. The account in the pages that follow is based on this unique collection, and it is presented not as transcripts, but rather as narrative and dialogue drawn from and based on them. The story that follows is a first-person account of what I found in this unique historical record. In telling this story, I have only edited the transcripts to make them readable and understandable, correcting the obvious anomalies that inevitably occur in spontaneous conversations, and often compressing material to report its essence. Almost all of the conversations from which this account is drawn are available online at the Nixon Presidential Library's website. The exceptions are those from June 1972, which are available at the Miller Center, which is devoted to presidential scholarship at the University of Virginia. The Nixon defense, both legal and political, because they were inseparable, was assembled behind closed doors in a process that began in the days following the arrests at the Watergate headquarters of the Democratic Party. The first public statement of a defense was made by Nixon on June 22, 1972, that nobody in his White House was involved in this bizarre incident. And Nixon's final firewall explanation of his defense was issued 11 months later, on May 22, 1973. The latter followed the firing of his top aides, including your author, who had become the centerpiece of his defense. Because I was deeply involved in and later the focus of the Nixon defense, I always hoped someone else would tell this story. I also understood such an undertaking meant the not easily accomplished task of transcribing all of Richard Nixon's Watergate conversations. Of course, we knew the broad outlines of his activities that led to his resignation, and he did provide some additional details in his memoir. But he, too, relied primarily on conversations that had been transcribed by investigators and prosecutors, leaving most of the historical facts buried in his secretly recorded conversations. Having now transcribed all those conversations and grasping the content of the newly transcribed material, I understand why he wanted no more information than was already easily available, made public. For while this additional information explains many of the activities he was responsible for, those rationales do not redound to Richard Nixon's glory. The National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, which Congress charged with the preservation of this historical Nixon material, has prepared, and continues to update and refine as they have released more of the Nixon recordings, a detailed subject log highlighting all the content of all the recorded conversations. This can be used to identify topics and the persons addressed, along with times and dates. No one has ever bothered to identify all the Watergate conversations that can be located with these subject logs. Today, that can be done digitally. When I did it in 2009, I had to do it manually, which took several months. although given the volume of material, even today, it would take almost as long. Depending on how you count them, as it is not always clear when one conversation ends and another begins, there are approximately 1,000 Watergate-related conversations.
We've just heard The Nixon Defense by John Dean. To those who love history, author David Reynolds needs no introduction. He's a leading historian, a professor of international history at Cambridge University, and winner of the Wolfson Prize for his 2005 monumental work, In Command of History, Churchill Fighting and Writing the Second World War. Now, Reynolds turns his attention to World War I in The Long Shadow, The Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century. World War I has become a ghostly war, fought in a haze of memory, often seen as a distant preamble to World War II. In The Long Shadow, Reynolds broadens our vision by assessing the impact of the Great War across the 20th century. He shows how World War II, the Cold War, and the collapse of communism shaped and reshaped attitudes to 1914 to 1918. John Fitzgibbons performs the book that offers a rich and layered examination not only of politics, but of diplomacy and security, economics, art, and literature.
1914 to 18 is the forgotten conflict of America's war-torn 20th century. Forgotten, yet also essential. Essential in guiding the United States when waging the Second World War and handling its aftermath, to avoid the mistakes of 1917 to 19. Essential, too, in helping define the country's self-image across the whole 20th century as a redemptive force in a world scarred by European imperialism. For a nation that was economically precocious in the 1900s, yet deeply insecure about its social coherence, the bloodbath that swamped Europe between August 1914 and November 1918 could be seen as bizarrely reassuring, proof that American values were superior and must be the basis of a new world order. This ideology was articulated above all by President Woodrow Wilson. His ambitions came to nothing in 1919-20. The massive stroke he suffered while campaigning for the League of Nations served to couple political failure with personal tragedy in a way that has haunted the American political imagination. But Wilson's ideas were resurrected and reworked to wage the War of 1941-45 and the Cold War that followed. Repackaged by 21st century neoconservatives, they also played a central role in the War on Terror. The Great War was America's first real involvement in great power politics outside the Western Hemisphere, and the way Wilson addressed that challenge has been a reference point, good or bad, for subsequent policymakers. Perhaps more than any other president, Wilson has served as a symbol of the American people's hopes and aspirations, and equally of their frustrations and disappointments. Wilson's ideology, too, has been susceptible to different emphases. Either a comprehensive system of international security, a League of Nations, which implied coexistence and cooperation among states, or the promotion of democratic values, self-determination, and human rights, a world made safe for democracy, which implied unilateral American action. But although Wilsonianism has proved a conflicted concept, its central predicate was clear: the folly of the old world and the virtue of the new world. The novelist F. Scott Fitzgerald conveyed this idea vividly in Tender is the Night, 1934. "See that little stream?" Dick Diver tells his companion as they tour the old Somme battlefield near Thiepval. "We could walk to it in 2 minutes. It took the British a whole month to walk to it. A whole empire, walking very slowly, dying in front and pushing forward behind. And another empire walked very slowly backward a few inches a day, leaving the dead like a million bloody rugs." Then comes Dick's punchline: No Europeans will ever do that again in this generation. But they did. Not exactly like the Battle of the Somme in 1916, it must be admitted, but between 1937 and 1945, empires walked again and again across the world, fighting and dying in even larger numbers, on battlefields of mud, snow, desert, and jungle, also in great cities under a hail of bombs, or in squalid camps amid clouds of gas. After that war had ended, and with it the last pretensions of Europe as the center of civilization, the United States assumed a self-appointed role as world policeman to avert World War III and perhaps the destruction of the planet. In the process, notably in Vietnam, America was drawn into the mass killing and moral compromises from which it had once proudly claimed to stand aloof. In 1979, American diplomat and sage George F. Kennan characterized the First World War as the great seminal catastrophe of this century. He was struck by the overwhelming extent to which communism, Nazism, and the Second World War were all the products of the first great Holocaust of 1914 to 18.
That was The Long Shadow by David Reynolds. Winston Churchill survived World War II to write a 6-volume memoir in which he portrayed his leadership, including his military leadership, in a very favorable light. Most Allied senior commanders also wrote memoirs in which they highlighted the important roles they played in the conflict. Franklin Roosevelt died before the war's end, and although he left some notes for a future memoir, he was unable to provide an account of his wartime leadership as commander-in-chief. In The Mantle of Command, FDR at War, 1941-42, Nigel Hamilton argues strongly that because FDR did not live to write a memoir, most historians have downplayed or overlooked how well he discharged his duties as commander-in-chief. Based on years of archival research and interviews with surviving aides and Roosevelt family members, Hamilton offers a definitive account of FDR's masterful and underappreciated command of the Allied war effort. Hamilton takes listeners into meetings where he battled with Churchill about strategy and tactics and overrode near mutinies of his own generals and Secretary of War. Time and again, FDR was proven right, and his allies and generals were wrong. When the generals wanted to attack the Nazi-fortified coast of France, FDR knew the Allied forces were not ready. When Churchill insisted his Far East colonies were loyal and would resist the Japanese, Roosevelt knew it was fantasy. And North Africa, in late 1942, the tide of war turns in the Allies' favor, and FDR's genius for psychology and military affairs becomes crystal clear. James Langton performs the book.
The plan of escape, as Roosevelt called it, was simple. It was also deceitful, the sort of adventure that the president, confined to the White House by the burden of his responsibilities as well as his wheelchair, loved. He would pretend to go on a fishing trip on his 165-foot presidential yacht, the USS Potomac, similar to the vacation he had taken earlier in the spring. In reality, he would secretly transfer from the floating White House to an American battleship or cruiser lying off the New England coast, then race up to Canadian waters to meet with the embattled British Prime Minister, Mr. Winston Churchill, the man who, for more than a year, had been leading his country in a lonely struggle against the Third Reich, following the fall of France and most of Europe. FDR had suggested such a meeting several times since January 1941, when his emissary, Harry Hopkins, first put the idea to Churchill on a visit to London. The purpose was, according to Roosevelt's own account, which he dictated for the historical record and a magazine article, one that sadly he never completed, to talk over the problem of the defeat of Germany. The proposed date, mentioned at the time, the president stated in his narrative, was to be March or April of that spring. However, the tortuous passage of the vast Lend-Lease Bill through Congress and other important legislation made it impossible for him to leave Washington before the early summer, and by that time the war in Greece and later the war in Crete prevented Churchill, Roosevelt explained. The trip was mentioned again in May and June, the president narrated, but talk of such a meeting was overshadowed by a more momentous event than Hitler's predations in the Mediterranean. For on June 22, 1941, the German invasion of Russia began, Hitler launching several million mobilized German troops in a do-or-die effort to smash the Soviet Union before turning back to the problematic invasion of England. And the U.S. Secretary of War, Colonel Henry Stimson, feared eventual war with the United States. 3 weeks later, a date for the Anglo-American summit was finally decided. It would take place, the President and Prime Minister concurred, in a mutually agreed-upon location between August 8th and 10th, 1941. The initial site chosen was the British island of Bermuda. Canada, though, considered by the President to be safer, met with final approval by both leaders. An official U.S. presidential visit to the capital city of Ottawa was mooted as cover for the meeting, with a secret side trip to the coast, allowing Roosevelt to meet Churchill upon his arrival. A problem was foreseen, however, in other British Dominion premiers asking to join the powwow. Such a gathering would have raised all sorts of political questions back in Washington, where a suspicious isolationist Congress would have to be informed and involved. It had thus been decided that only the President and Mr. Churchill would meet aboard their anchored battleships, preferably in a protected 60-mile-wide gulf of the Newfoundland coast called Placentia Bay, named for a French naval station that had existed there before the British conquest. Though the waters were Canadian, the naval station at Argentia had been ceded to the United States for 99 years as a quid pro quo in the previous year's Destroyers for Bases deal to help Britain fight the Nazis. Following its acquisition, it had been expanded to provide U.S. Army Air Force protection and was already handling U.S. Navy minesweepers. Shore-based communications could also be provided if required. From the President's perspective, however, it would above all be an American venue, putting the Prime Minister at a disadvantage in the same way that visitors to Louis XIV were made to climb 1,000 steps at Versailles before meeting the French monarch.
We've just heard The Mantle of Command by Nigel Hamilton. Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard are staples of the bestseller lists, with their titles Killing Lincoln, Killing Kennedy, and Killing Jesus. Now the pair bring us Killing Patton, the strange death of World War II's most audacious general. General Patton died under mysterious circumstances in the months following the end of World War II. For almost 70 years, there's been suspicion that his death may not have been an accident and may very well have been an act of assassination. Killing Patton, narrated by O'Reilly, takes listeners inside the final year of the war and recounts events surrounding Patton's demise, naming names of powerful individuals who wanted him silenced.
But reporters are the least of General Patton's worries. Throughout the course of the Second World War, he made many high-ranking enemies in Moscow, Berlin, London, and even Washington, D.C. Patton's fiery determination to speak the truth had many powerful men squirming, not only during the war, but also afterward. He recently went on the record praising his former German enemies for their skills as soldiers, while also criticizing the Soviet Union as being a foe rather than an ally of the USA. Some have come to see Patton as a roadblock to world peace, and now Patton is at his most vulnerable, an easy target for any of those enemies. A year to this day, General Patton was in the midst of the most glorious battle of his career, racing across France with his beloved Third Army to rescue American forces pinned down at the crossroads in Bastogne, Belgium. The German army had long considered Patton to be the Allies' greatest general, but the Battle of the Bulge, as it would become known, elevated him to legendary status throughout the world. Now, the swaggering, fearless renegade who prowled the front lines in a specially modified Dodge WC-57 command car outfitted with a 50-caliber machine gun, siren, and two air horns to announce his arrival is hidden from the public. The George S. Patton who sleeps fitfully as Friday evening descends upon Heidelberg has a low pulse and a high fever. He drank eggnog for lunch and for a time felt upbeat, but his energy sagged before he finally fell asleep. A blood clot in his lungs made his face turn blue yesterday, and there are fears that another embolism might soon give him more trouble breathing. The auto accident was brutal. Stitches and bruising cover Patton's head from the bridge of his nose to the top of his scalp, marking the line where doctors sewed a Y-shaped flap of his skin back onto his head. His face is gaunt from weight loss, and there are open holes in his cheekbones where doctors drilled into his face to insert steel fish hooks to hold his head in traction. But the general has a high pain threshold and has endured his sufferings with a smile and his usual blue humor. He banters with the nurses who find him cute. Despite the fact that he has taken a sudden and unexpected turn for the worse in the past few days, the general still expects to be flown to Beverly General Hospital in Boston to further his recovery. Beatrice has been with him around the clock, reading to him and calling for the doctors when he has a hard time catching his breath. She has a small room of her own down the hall, but is rarely there. The former heiress is a plain woman with a charismatic personality who wed Patton just a year after he graduated from West Point. Throughout their 35 years of marriage, Beatrice has braved the many hardships of military life for her beloved Georgie, never wavering in her love and support. Suddenly, Patton wakes up. His dark blue eyes flick back and forth, searching for signs of Beatrice. There she is. "Are you all right, Georgie?" Beatrice asks. She is every bit as fiery as her husband, a fearless equestrian and accomplished sailor. Patton gazes intensely at his wife. She is the only woman he ever truly loved and the mother of his three children. Beatrice leans forward to pat her husband's hand. "It's so dark," Patton says, "so late." He closes his eyes and falls back to sleep. Beatrice soon leaves for the hospital mess, where she hopes to grab a quick dinner before returning to the bedside, not knowing that her husband has just spoken his last words. At 6 p.m., the urgent news is delivered for Beatrice to return immediately to room 110. But she is too late. The general whom Nazi Germany feared more than any other, the former Olympic pentathlete, the cavalry officer who once hunted the infamous Pancho Villa across the desert plains of Mexico, and the warrior who publicly stated that he wanted one day to be killed by, quote, "the last bullet in the last battle of the last war," is already dead.
We've just heard Killing Patton by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. With a unique, witty voice, historian Robert O'Connell breaks down the easily caricatured character of General William T. Sherman, serving up the most well-rounded portrait of the man we've seen to date. Fierce Patriot, The Tangled Lives of William Tecumseh Sherman, offers new insights into Sherman, the military strategist, and into Uncle Billy, Sherman's popular persona, the charismatic leader of the Army of the West. O'Connell also makes a compelling case that Sherman's march through the South was not a campaign of unmitigated destruction. He also portrays how central Sherman was to the success of the Transcontinental Railroad in the post-war years. Andrew Garman performs the book that sets out to show that Sherman's goal was to keep the United States united.
One prominent Civil War historian, Gary Gallagher, described Sherman as lacking cognitive filters. It all came out. And this is a real problem in trying to resurrect the man's nature. One approach that seems to help is to draw a distinction between the Sherman of vast opinion and the walk-around quotidian Sherman. The former said and wrote a great deal that could be used against him. The latter was an almost compulsively gregarious individual who normally treated other people, even adversaries, courteously and reasonably. He could even be a good listener. He almost never lost his temper. The worse the situation, the more clear-headed Sherman became. To contemporaries, he was a jumble of sagacity, rectitude, shoot-from-the-hip sincerity, prepotency, and grumpiness, all rolled into a unique being known and beloved by Americans simply as Uncle Billy, the nickname originally bestowed upon him by his men during the Civil War. Other military heroes were similarly revered: Jackson, Grant, Eisenhower, but partially as politicians. Uncle Billy was always just a soldier, our only true celebrity general. But he was also one with a sardonic, at times even self-mocking, sense of humor. Consider Sherman answering the door in the middle of the night for an important dispatch with a cheery, "I have seen the devil, have you?" Or imagine him in the middle of a battle coming upon a soldier cowering behind a tree and loudly proclaiming his intention to desert, prompting Sherman to shower the tree with rocks, convincing the reluctant warrior he was under even heavier fire. Crazy Billy. That, too, was part of the image. We have no analog today. If you wanted to point to an individual in recent memory who most resembles Sherman, one choice might be Katharine Hepburn, a supermasculine version, but with the same prickly combination of irrepressible self-righteousness, good sense, and charisma. If nothing else, this comparison calls attention to an aspect not much noted. Sherman was, to an extraordinary degree, theatrical. This quality is useful militarily, especially when convincing others to risk their lives. But Sherman took it well beyond that. The theater was his favorite form of recreation, and players, often female players, would one day occupy a large portion of his social life. More to the point, Sherman was instinctively theatrical in much that he did. His famously disheveled Civil War uniforms, tailored by Brooks Brothers, incidentally, were absolutely on the mark for the Democratic volunteers manning the Army of the West. Later in his career, there is little of that. Photographs capture a sartorially appropriate, even dapper Sherman, acting out his role as commanding general of the United States Army. His life was undeniably dramatic, but you also have the feeling he framed it as such, the central character in his personal production. All the controversies, his endless battles with the press, his famous feuds, it seems apparent he would have had it no other way. Yet we will never actually see him in character, for we are separated by an electronic divide that precludes hearing the voice and cadence of this most talkative of men. Similarly, the few images we have freeze a figure who was almost never at rest and reduce his famously spiky red hair and grizzled beard to a kind of black-and-white mediocrity.
That was Fierce Patriot by Robert O'Connell. In this highly anticipated follow-up to his blockbuster, The Amateur, former New York Times Magazine editor-in-chief Edward Klein delves into the rocky relationship between the Obamas and the Clintons in Blood Feud. An old-school reporter with incredible insider contacts, Klein reveals just how deep the rivalry between the Obamas and the Clintons run, with details on closed-door meetings buttressed by hundreds of interviews. Lars Michelson narrates this stunning exposé of the animosity, jealousy, and competition between America's two most powerful political couples.
Barack Obama was in a funk. He was slouched in a big leather chair, one knee propped against the edge of the conference table, a sullen expression on his face. For the past half hour, he'd been listening with mounting exasperation as two of his closest advisors, David Plouffe and Valerie Jarrett, indulged in a heated debate over how to save him from political calamity. It was August 2011. And in less than 15 months, Obama would face the American people in a bid for a second term in the White House. Since FDR, only one Democratic president, Bill Clinton, had managed that feat. And according to Plouffe, who had replaced David Axelrod as Obama's chief in-house campaign strategist, the president's prospects looked iffy at best. The latest Gallup poll had Obama at the lowest monthly job approval rating of his presidency, with only 41% of adults approving of his performance. The spare and wiry Plouffe was an intense man of few words, a numbers genius, and a formidable competitor. Though Obama's re-election headquarters was officially based 700 miles away in Chicago, Plouffe ruled the campaign from inside the West Wing. "We have to play hardball," Plouffe said, according to a person who took part in the meeting. "We have to bury our Republican opponent with attack ads. And we need a popular figure, a point man in the campaign, someone who will excite the base and independents and be the president's chief surrogate. In my opinion, the best person for that job is Bill Clinton." Normally, in meetings like this, no one questioned Plouffe's authority. But as he spoke in favor of enlisting Bill Clinton in the campaign, Plouffe appeared uncharacteristically nervous. He kept glancing down the table at Valerie Jarrett, who sat a few feet away. Jarrett's eyes were ablaze with defiance. Before they gathered for this pivotal campaign strategy meeting, Plouffe had met privately with Jarrett and given her a heads up. He told her that he planned to urge Obama to approach Bill Clinton, who was widely despised by members of Obama's inner circle, and ask the former president for help in the coming electoral struggle. As Plouffe expected, his proposal did not go down well with Jarrett. Her dislike of the Clintons, especially Bill, seemed boundless. Instead, Jarrett suggested that the point person in the campaign should be Oprah Winfrey, whose legendary persuasive powers, especially among women and minorities, was known among opinion poll researchers as the Oprah effect. Jarrett believed that Oprah was more likely to stay on message and be much more controllable than Bill Clinton. During the 2008 presidential election, Oprah had taken a big gamble with her TV ratings by shedding her nonpartisan reputation and going all out for Barack Obama. She headlined massive rallies and raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for his campaign. And she was widely credited with pulling in more than 1 million votes. In return for her support, Oprah had been promised unique access to the White House by Obama if he won. She would get regular briefings on administration initiatives and advance notice on programs, which would give her invaluable material for her fledgling cable venture, OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network. Oprah intended to make her unique White House access a part of her new network, a source close to Oprah said in an interview for this book. There were big plans, and a team was put together to come up with proposals that would have been mutually beneficial. But none of that ever happened. Oprah sent notes and a rep to talk to Valerie Jarrett, but nothing came of it. It slowly dawned on Oprah that the Obamas had absolutely no intention of keeping their word and bringing her into their confidence. In a snit, Oprah banned the Obamas from her O, the Oprah magazine, and rumors persisted that she would sit out the 2012 election. Clearly, Oprah believed she was being rebuffed at the level of Michelle and Valerie, this source continued. And just as obviously, President Obama didn't interfere on Oprah's behalf. It appeared to Oprah that Michelle was jealous of her, furious that Barack was seeking her advice instead of Michelle's. For her part, Oprah didn't like being with Michelle, because the First Lady was constantly one-upping the president and anybody else around her. Oprah was hurt and angry and would never make up with the Obamas. She knows how to hold a grudge.
We've just heard Blood Feud by Edward Klein. What is history but a fable agreed upon? Readers, I think I must disagree with this quote from Napoleon. I believe the books we've previewed today present facts and perspectives new to our consciousness. For more newsworthy titles, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.